Welcome to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series.
Boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series. This is episode 39. I'm trying to think of a pun about 39 steps, but some of the audience might not realise that. There's a book called 39 Steps, isn't there, Stephen?
Well, if we take 9 minus 3, that gives us 6, then we've got 69. That would be interesting.
Oh, God, I trust you to put that spin on it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're back for another half hour, 40 minutes, and we're still up in Chiang Mai, North Thailand, an hour's flight north of Bangkok, on episode 39. And if you listened to last week's podcast, you'll know that we're going to talk about, well, we did say Japan and Taiwan, but after having sort of our 3-hour pre-podcast planning meeting, tongue-in-cheek, this is going to be about Japan and Tokyo in particular. But before that, we have an announcement. Stephen, what's the announcement?
It's your 25th wedding anniversary.
Oh, no! Oh, God. We're going to have to write a script about these things. Actually, he's absolutely right. My 25th wedding anniversary is going to come up. So this
we're going to do a podcast on 25 years of marriage.
Really?
Chris and Nong.
Yeah,
I'm going to interview him.
Really?
That'd be good.
You're going to interview me, right?
Okay, we'll let you off that one. No, the announcement is that the announcement is that the Relationship Manifesto is now out for public consumption worldwide through the blessings of Amazon.com, and you can access it and download it and enjoy the read. And it will shortly be available. Where else, Chris? You're the expert on the. You're the publisher. Where else is it coming out?
Nobody's ever said you're the publisher to me before.
You are the publisher.
I know, it's good.
It says Christopher Smith on the Amazon.
I know.
Publisher.
Oh, you checked that out, did you?
Yeah.
I'm now a mogul, a publishing mogul.
You are.
No, it's on Amazon, so it can be downloaded from there. And it doesn't matter what device you have, because Amazon, bless their socks, but it's for commercial reasons, of course, is have readers for most devices. So you can download a Kindle reader on your iPad. You can download Kindle onto other Android devices. Of course, if you have a Kindle reader, they've optimized their books to look better on there, so they say. How you find it is there is a URL, there is a web address, and I'll put that in the notes to this podcast. But the easiest way for you to find it is just go to Amazon.com and search for Relationship Manifesto, and it comes up there. I noticed when we first put it up, it came up at number 4, but I think it's coming up as number 1 now. There were a couple of other books with relationship in their title. So there's that. And our next element of the development plan is that we'll be putting it in the iTunes store. For those who are a bit techie, and sorry to bore the others, but what was interesting, it was actually very difficult to embed, almost impossible to embed the multimedia into the book itself in Amazon. So the audios and the videos that we've made to be part of the book, to supplement the book, are web links in the book, and you click on them and you go to a browser probably and listen to the audio or watch the video. Whereas with the Apple, I'm really optimistic that it will all be embedded, so you don't need to be connected to the internet. But it's really exciting. It's up there, isn't it?
It's out.
It's brilliant.
It's great.
It's there.
Yeah, pleased, and people are buying it. So thank you to all the people who are buying it, and to the many more who will buy it. And we'll have it as a hard copy at some point, I think, New Year. So yeah, that's finished, and on to the next project. But yeah, good.
Yeah, you could actually, if you're a real Anglophile, you could go to Amazon.co.uk and you can buy the book in pounds instead of US dollars. Or you can go to the French store. I don't know why the French store stands so out prominently. Something must be some rules about in France about ebooks. But you can buy it in euros there if you like. And we did click the button which told Amazon to do the conversions to different currencies. So I suppose it should be the same price wherever you buy it. But yeah, actually, you might want to search around. You might find one Amazon store is cheaper than another. So.
Yeah, and finally, anybody who wants to contact me about the book, having downloaded it, read it, any aspects that you agree with, you find particularly contentious, disagreeable, or absolutely think are wonderful, I'm very happy to communicate with you. Please, you know, contact me by email. You can get my email address through my website, www.stephen-whitehead.com. And yeah, talk to me about the book and yeah, be good. There we go.
Actually, the book only went online this week, and I'm really impressed because Stephen embedded the links to the book in his own website himself.
That's
without
amazing.
Any help. Which,
that
which
was
you
quite
know,
an achievement. That was almost as
brilliant.
Difficult it's
as almost a round of applause. Everybody, give him a round of applause for that.
Yeah, you know, well, that's more than a bit of irony because I, you know, that anyway, we did it.
I think that's brilliant.
Okay, so now on to Tokyo, somewhere that an amazing place. Yeah, I was there end of October. Only for a few days, but it had an impact on me. Before I kick off here, there's a few people I want to thank about for the Tokyo and Taipei experience. And I say, as Chris said earlier, we're going to do a separate podcast on Taipei because I think there's enough to be said about Japan and sex. But first of all, the people I want to thank are Trey Dobson, Patrick Lee, Moto, and Shin in Tokyo, and in Taipei, Joy Chang, Gavin Whitehead, my eldest son, and Catherine Chen. So thank you to all of you because you all made some contribution to my journey and my experiences in different ways, and were very important. It gave me some insights into what's going on in these particular cultures. And although I'm living out here in Thailand and have done now on and off for quite a number of years, Japan is very different, as is Taiwan, as is China, and as are all these countries. Now, when I went to Tokyo, I was staying in a hotel which is in the Shinjuku area. And those of you who don't know Tokyo will not be aware that that's one of the main sex districts of the city.
Stephen, how do you spell that? Because then people can sort of do a Google search for it.
It's Shinjuku, Shinjuku. Okay. And the hotel is a superb hotel. I mean, it's not a seedy area, but it's not like, you know, for example, like, how can I say, like Soho in London or maybe even the sex district in Amsterdam. It's all mainstream. There's office blocks and all the rest of it going off there and supermarkets. But there's also a lot of sex work activities in that district. The other district that's adjacent to it is Kabukicho, and that's spelled Kabukicho. And it seems that Kabukicho and Shinjuku are pretty much the same area. There's a third area, which is where the gay sex district is, and that's a little bit less pronounced, less obvious. That's Shinjuku Nikome. That's Shinjuku plus Nikome as a separate word, Nichome. I went around all the areas over the period I was there, and observing and watching, and fascinating really, because having been in numerous sex districts around the world, what strikes you about Tokyo? It's very bright, very visual, it's very neon, the whole thing's kicking off early in the evening, and it doesn't really finish until early in the morning, and you're still getting people working it and people going there for to partake at, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. You've got the office workers going in the morning. Fascinating. What do you see early in at night there when you're walking around? The first thing that I spotted were these Japanese youths standing on the corners, all dressed in black shirt or white shirt and black tie, or black shirt, black tie, or purple shirt, black tie. Thin-faced, quite attractive Japanese young men, around the ages of 19, 20, 21, maybe a bit older. Most of them with fancy wavy hair, which is not black. They've had it dyed, usually in auburn or coloured or blonde or whatever. Almost like cartoon characters. And they're on the mobile phones, they're stood there watching. They don't approach you. They certainly didn't approach me and my friends when we were there. And they're part of this underworld, if you like, that constitutes the visual aspects of the sex districts of this Shinjuku, big area of Shinjuku in the centre of Tokyo, which Tokyo itself is a big city, one of the biggest metropolises in the world, 20 million population now and expanding.
It's 20 million in Tokyo. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's massive. The greater Tokyo area is big. Now, so you see these Japanese young men, and it's a bit, I don't know, it's not intimidating, but it's almost, I find it almost amusing because they're so stereotypically cartoonish Japanese characters, you know. They don't seem to be doing very much, but they're on the mobile phones all the time. And there's loads of them that stood around, and you wonder what they do. But then there's another type of guy who's become very prominent in the sex districts of Tokyo, particularly Shinjuku and Kabukicho, and these are the West African heavies. So you've got the, apparently they're mostly from Nigeria, but also from other parts of West Africa. And they are black males, mostly I would say over 25, in the 30s. And they are very different. They're a very different style. They're not on so much on the mobile phones. They're looking for people like me. And they come up to you constantly, inviting you to the hostess bars, saying, you want a girl? We've got just a friend, just a person for you, my mate, and all the rest of it. And they do it in this sort of Western African lingo. Call you captain, and we know what you're looking for tonight. Well, so you want, this is happening all around you constantly, and as long as you're humorous, you know, you take it in a humorous way, you don't feel intimidated by it or put off by it, then it's okay. They seem to operate, these West African heifers seem to operate in a certain physical space. So I was observing them, you know, coming on to other people and myself. And once you, if you keep walking, they don't follow you after a certain part. They'd only follow you so far, and then you get picked up by someone else. So it's right. Like this parade of,
yes,
West African males will pick up on you walking down the sex districts. But you have to be careful, because it's very easy just to turn around and say, okay, yeah, I'm interested, or just maybe just out of curiosity, and then you get whipped off to some bar, and then before you know it, you can spend a lot of money, because these places are not cheap. It's not like Bangkok or other parts of Southeast Asia, or Phnom Penh, for example. It's expensive. You can be well into hundreds of pounds just going to a bar and buying a few drinks,
yes,
and that's before you've had bought any time with anybody. This aspect of it, you've got to be switched on to it and think. Most of the people that they are attracting, I think, to the sex districts of Tokyo are the Japanese businessmen, and they're steaming off out of the offices around about 7 or 8 o'clock at night, pretty much every night, but particularly at weekends. And many of them are heading to this sex districts, and they're going to the hostess bars, they're going to the, what else have you got there? You've got the bathhouses, or what they call the soplands. You've got the massage parlours, some of which are very official and legit and professional, some of them which are effectively brothels. You've got the video shops, which are probably no different from any other video shop you see in, you know, London or Amsterdam. Yeah. And you've got loads now of these quite upmarket love hotels, and they are big, well established, well appointed love hotels, and there's all many of them. There's a whole street of love hotels now established in this part of the sex district of Tokyo, just over the last few years.
Where the guys would take a girl to, or the girls are there?
The girls are not there. You take the girls to the love motel, to the love hotels, and they are very fancy and not cheap, but you know, the upmarket.
I have a vision of theme rooms.
Absolutely. You've got all the theme rooms and all the paraphernalia that goes with it. And the other thing to remember is that there's Japanese themselves are going there. Japanese couples. Maybe even married couples are going there for a bit of fun. Or girl boyfriends are going who can't have sex at home because they haven't got a home. They can't afford a condo. The bloke's living with his mum and dad. The girl's living with her mum and dad. There's no way they're going to have sex anywhere other than in one of these love motels, and that's one reason why they're becoming more popular and more established.
Yeah, that's a similar situation in Hong Kong, is that young couples are living at home with parents.
Yeah.
And the whole string of hotels like that all around Hong Kong, not so opulent, I don't think, as you just described, but so crowded that it's a one way of actually getting a bit of privacy.
It is, that's absolutely right, and they are getting privacy, and the businessmen are using them to take escorts there, or girls they've met. But you, the interesting thing about one of the interesting things about Japan is that it looks very, how can I say, it looks like there's a lot of sex going on, and I guess there is, but it's not so much in your face, if you like, as it would be in other parts of the world. You've got to look for it a bit harder, I think, in Tokyo. Certainly if you're a Westerner, there's lots of social codes that you've got to deconstruct and work through. I'm talking about the sex work now. And you've also got to prepare, it's going to cost money. I mean, if they're advertising in the more explicit brothels, they're advertising a sort of sexy soapy massage for about £100 for 30 minutes, which compare that's about 5,000 baht, for example, in Thailand. The same thing in Thailand would be one-fifth of that, one-twentieth of that. So it's not cheap. And the other thing about Japan and the sex work is, and something I'm going to talk about more when I come on to the Taipei phenomenon, is that, like many parts of Southeast Asia, the actual sex work in Japan is illegal. But it's the coitus that's illegal. It's penetrative sex is illegal. So mutual masturbation or oral or something like that type of sex activity is not illegal. So what happens if the police raid a place? And of course, the police are tied up with the underworld who protect the whole
Yakuza.
Thing. Yakuza, they're all over the place. What happens if someone, unfortunately enough, gets caught in the middle of a police raid and it's coitus interruptus? Well, apparently, so I've been told, you then all you have to do is you claim that you've fallen in love. So you go to a soap land, you have a sexy massage, that sexy massage moves on to penetrative sex. The worst case scenario, which is not going to happen very often, but the worst case scenario is that the police happen to raid at the moment you're having penetrative sex. Your defence is simply that you fell in love during the soapy massage, and then you're okay. So if you that's a very legitimate defence, and you're not going to get prosecuted.
If only Bill Clinton had known.
It's strange, isn't it? It's a wonderful little anecdote because it's apparently it's true. So the Japanese get round these rather archaic laws on sex work through this little medium, and this brings me to another term, and I want to mention this because I'm going to mention it again in the Taipei podcast, and this is the term that was given to me by Catherine Cheng. Hi, Catherine. Now, Catherine's a PhD student at a university in Taipei. And in a recent interaction, communication with her, she's given me this term, the liberated closet. And I think that's a fascinating term, and it's brilliant, because what the concept of the liberated closet is absolutely applicable to many, many of these countries. They're liberated to a point, but they're living in this closet of constraint, social inhibition, traditional value systems.
You're talking about couples or single?
I'm talking about this operates for individuals, it can operate for couples, and it can operate for whole society. Okay. So if you take the concept of the liberated closet and apply it to Tokyo or to Japan, and in terms of how Japan's dealing with sex work, it's exactly that. It's liberated because they allow people to get away with coitus with having sex through the device of saying, I fell in love with the sex worker. Okay. Yes. But it's a closet in so much as you have to do that anyway, that all this operates within very, very strict boundaries of social behaviour.
Yeah.
And the boundaries of social behaviour between the genders in Japan are awesome. One of the things you notice when you go to Tokyo is the fact that no one looks at you. And I thought, well, this is because I'm a Westerner. And then I realised no one's looking at anybody else.
Really?
Really. You can go in the underground in Tokyo and everybody's got their eyes about 3 or 4 metres ahead. Nobody's looking anybody else in the eye. There's very little eye contact. And apparently, when I talk to Japanese people, Japanese friends there, and people who've lived out there a long time, they tell me that it's a big no-no to look at anybody in the eye for any long time. It's considered confrontational.
Mm.
So everybody's walking ahead, unless you're talking to someone at the same time. You're not stirring.
Right.
And this is interesting in terms of how people make eye contact, because one of the ways in which couples, same sex or straight sex, meet or connect is through eye contact. Now, my friend Trey put it to me very well, and he's lived out in Japan now, in Tokyo, for about, a good many years, maybe 15 years or more. He said to me, put it this way, he said, around the world, he said, you've probably got a 90-second eye contact operate. So if you look at someone for between 60 and 90 seconds, it's usually signaling, and it's a smile attached, and it's a nice look. It's signaling interest.
Yeah.
But it's got to be that long in order to get beyond the normal boundaries of eye contact and operate around the world. So eye contact for a few seconds doesn't mean anything.
Yes.
So if I'm walking in London, I look at someone and give a nice smile, and it's that eye contact, 60, 90 seconds, that's signaling interest.
Yes.
In Japan, that's reduced to about 30 seconds. That's the difference. So if you're in Tokyo...
That's still a long time.
It's still a lot of time. Yeah, yeah. And it's a vast time for someone for Japanese couples,
yes,
or Japanese people who don't make that eye contact.
Yeah.
So what you but I can't help but look at people. I'm a sociologist. I'm fascinated by the body language and what's going on around me. And what do I see when I'm in Tokyo? I see some gorgeous women. You know, I mean, the guys are good looking. And if you're gay, then, you know, gay men come out east, because the men out east are very, very attractive. But the women, for me, that's stunning. And I was really impressed by the look of the Japanese women, the younger ones, say from 18 onwards, and the older ones in the 40s and 50s, look good. Now, I know Japan's a wealthy city, and I'm not talking about the mass of underclass people who are, you know, outside the social categories, if you like. But certainly, you look, you travel around Japan during a weekday or a weekend. You look at the young women; they look good. They dress smart. They dress well. They dress in a very conscious way. And they dress in a very girly way. It's very emphasized femininity that the Japanese women perform. So you have short skirts, but not tight, but pleated. A typical girl would be a pleated tartan dress about 3 or 4 inches above her knee. Sexy. Nice legs. The Japanese are slim, but not like the way the British women have gone. Sorry, British women. You know, when you get to 23% of you are obese, classified, as has come out in the recent research, it's not good. You don't see that in the East. And the Japanese women are generally slim. There are some fatter ones, but not many. They keep themselves slim. It's partly to do with the diet, of course. But you've got these nice shapes. They're not too tall. They're very conscious about what they were. The makeup, there'll be ribbons in the hair, pigtails. They'll have a designer handbag. They'll have boots on, or they'll have smally boots with stockings. They'll have a nice top. They look very, very heavily feminine in a young girl way. So you've got 30-year-old women dressing like 17, 18-year-olds, and that's very typical. And I was struck by this because I was attracted to them. I think they look absolutely gorgeous. Appeal to my sense of femininity. And many men. But then when you look around, you get to know a bit more about Japanese society. There's an anomaly here, which is really quite fascinating. And that is that the men are not having as much sex. Married couples, apparently research that's come out recently, over the last few years, shows that up to 50% of married couples in Japan have not had sex at all over the last month. They're not even kissing. The women of Japan appear to be more liberated and out and available and presented themselves in a very sexy way, but the guys are not interested. There's a social group of young males emerged in Japan called the herbivores or lotus eaters, and they are a young man that have been classified as being very heavily extremist metrosexual, and that is, they're not gay, they are straight, but they're just not interested in sex. Again, recent research comes out looking at this age group of between 16 and 20. Up to 80%, 85% of that age group of young men, 16 to 20, not interested in sex. Not interested, not having sex. 50% of men at the age of 20 have no boyfriend, no girlfriends. They're not engaging with sex. Married couples are not having as much sex. The young men are not interested in sex or pursuing the opposite sex or even the same sex. Something's happening in Japanese society, and this is reflected in the declining birth rate, which, by comparison, say, with the USA, the birth rate in the USA and the UK is about 13 per thousand. In Japan, it's dropped to 7 per thousand, and the country's not even recreating itself. It carries on like this, Japan will be only immigrants. The Japanese will have gone out of existence. So the birth rate is at crisis point now. And there's definitely something going on with the sexual habits of young and older Japanese people. But when you've got a situation where 20-year-old men are not going out with girls, they're not looking for girls, they're watching porn, apparently. They're doing a lot of porn on television. They spend a lot of time in front of the computers.
There's the cartoons, because the description you gave of the girl just now with the pleated tartan schoolgirl dress, you look at the...
You recognise that.
Yeah, because of the Japanese cartoons. And you know, especially, you know, if you look at music videos from the Japanese, it's in there as well. There's a special name for that type of cartoon.
It is.
I forgot what it is.
I should have picked up on it, but it is there's a special name, and they're quite popular here in Thailand. You get a lot of Thais watching them as well, and the booklets. But it's an exaggerated form of gender. It's also the men and the women are almost androgynous. When I look at the young guys in the sex district who are part of the underworld linked to the Yakuza, the gangsters, who were maybe pimping for the escort girls, maybe.
Or are these the guys you talked about at the beginning? The young guys with their black suits on and their red ties or whatever. Yes. Yes.
Now I look at them. And I look at them as they're almost they're very feminine compared to the heavy West African men who are not feminine at all, but heavily masculine in their body language, in their talk, and in their dress code. The West African men are heavily masculine, very macho. The Japanese young men work in the same districts alongside the Nigerians or whatever. They're very feminine.
Yes.
They look girly. Their hairstyle, some of them got makeup on, and they dress in a way which is really not beyond, it's beyond metrosexual. It's a very feminine way.
Yes.
Feminine performance. And yet you've got the women of Japan who clearly are looking for encounters, but there's a problem.
Are the women tending to walk around with other women?
You get a lot of that, and you don't. It's similar to Thailand in this respect. There's very little physical contact between the sexes in public. You know, whereas in Thailand, you know that the Thais, men and women couples won't hold hands. They certainly won't kiss in public. You've got the same phenomena in Japan. So this is where it comes back to Catherine Chen's term, the liberated closet. I think you could apply that to the whole of Japan, really, and that's what it is. And there's an interesting book out on this, which I've just picked up by Mark West, called Lovesick Japan: Sex, Marriage, Romance, and Law. And Mark West's book, which is very interesting, recently published, picks up on a lot of this tension and contradiction between how Japanese men and women now are portraying themselves, trying to hold on to some traditional value system, influenced increasingly by Western globalization, but also how they're dealing with sex. And it's as if sex has been reduced to an occasional pastime. The men are heavily stressed, they're working long hours. The cost of living in Japan and Tokyo is phenomenal, and I'll give an example of that in a moment. But the working awesome hours. It's a very competitive culture. you've got to get into university to get a job with a major company. And in the past, where you had this salaryman model, where the men were the male breadwinners, dutiful wife stayed at home, brought the kids up, while the man worked in the, for Honda or Mitsubishi or whatever, and
for did, life.
For life. That's lifer. Going.
Yes.
That's going now. And the salarymen are under pressure. They're having to move between jobs. There's no longer a guarantee that you're going to get into a certain job if you've come out of a certain university with a certain degree and a certain subject. All this certainty, which prevailed around Japan from through the 60s and 70s and 80s, that's disappearing. It's becoming more like the UK, where you've got couples married, both having to work.
Yes.
And they're having to work a long hours.
Yes.
It's, again, this is something that's replicated in Taiwan, where the men and women, Taiwanese men and women, are not just working Monday to Friday, they're working 7 days a week often. Or they're working 6 days a week and not getting home till 10 o'clock at night for those 6 days.
Yes.
So you've got work pressures, you've got intensification of labour, you've got money worries, you've got stress, you've got high cost of living, you've got phenomenal prices of houses. Even if you could afford to have children, would you want to? Because you can only afford if you've got some, you can pay someone to look after them. Because if one of you is working in this intensified, heavily materialistic work culture, one of you's got to take time out altogether from work in order to bring the child up. This is why they're not having kids.
Mm.
And they're not having sex because they're too tired. The men are saying, the Japanese man is saying, I'm too tired to have sex. I'm not saying all Japanese men are in this situation, but there's a significant percentage, and we're talking 30-40% at least, over the age of 20. Now, this is where the sex districts start to come in, because they're picking up on this absence of sex. It's not that the sex districts are necessarily selling sex, and this is, again, an interesting thing to get used to.
That was going to be my question in my head already. It's are they really entertainment business areas?
This, again, there's a term I want to use here, and I'm going to have to give credit here to a Dr. Anne Mary Lynn Davis, and also to Adam Dedman, my friend at Pipe University, who put me onto this particular doctor, who's now, Dr. Davis has just recently completed a PhD. She's a USA PhD, just graduated. I've read Dr. Davis's PhD thesis, which is particularly interesting. And what Dr. Davis comes up with is this term, the pleasure worker. And I'm going to start using that because we've had this podcast in the past about sex worker, prostitute, sex work, and all the rest of it. I think the term pleasure worker is far more applicable, really, because it's not just about sex, and this is the research that Davis has done.
Yes.
And lots of research into sex work around the world. Now, the pleasure worker is something that's beyond the sexual contact. And that's what you see a lot of in Japan. You see it everywhere. I think anybody who's involved in pleasure work as a client or as a worker who's listened to this podcast will recognize there's a lot going on than just a sexual encounter. The intimacy, the emotional connection, which often takes place, the casual conversation, all this stuff. It's about pleasure.
The pleasure foreplay,
which is, invariably verbal before anybody's touched.
Yeah.
So let me give you an example of this operating in Tokyo, because I think the pleasure worker is a massive market in Tokyo, and they're picking up on these. I think the dysfunctional businessmen.
Dysfunctional.
I think the dysfunctional. They're not dysfunctional as businessmen, but they're dysfunctional as men.
Hmm.
And I'm sorry to have to say it, but I'm on the underground in Tokyo, and these guys are asleep. They're tired out.
Yes.
They're blanked out. They're zombified. Not the women. The women seem to be coping with it better, but the guys, they're all dressed the same, in the dark suits and the white shirts and the ties. It's this uniform that a Japanese office worker's got to wear. You know, there's no flexibility, no individuality. You've all cloned. If you're going to work for one of these corporations, this is what you've got to dress like.
Yes.
This is how you've got to behave.
Yes.
these guys are whacked out. I'm seeing them at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're asleep. 6 o'clock in the afternoon, they're zombified. Mm. Now, how did they relax? Well, they're not going home to relax, many of them, because they're not having sex with the wives. The wives may be working as well. They're going to the hostess bars, and these hostess bars are generally catering for locals, Japanese men. They're not catering for the tourists, and I don't think there'd be many tourists could even find them, to be honest. You'd need to be in Tokyo to find the more upmarket gentleman bars. Now, I'm going to call them gentleman bars, and they operate both in the sex, they operate both for the in the gay sex districts and in the straight sex districts. And I went into both types of bars. The gay ones were, the ones I went into were more lower key, maybe not so upmarket. And the way it operates in the gay hostess bar, if you like, is it all operates around the barman, and the barman's usually the owner. So you've got a small bar in a room, not very big, and the gay men coming in out from the offices looking for encounters with other gay men, will meet up in a bar. They'll have a few drinks, and the barman will introduce people to each other. So you've got maybe have 6 or 7 guys,
yes,
sat in a small bar area. No one's talking, because it's against, you don't usually get into open conversation. You need to be introduced, and the, yes, barman's skill is introducing one man to another man and, yes, getting the conversation going, and then those two men can have the chat, and if they, you know, kick off they go somewhere. We're not talking about sex work here, so we're not talking about prostitutes or sex workers or pleasure workers. These are just bars where people can encounter.
Yes.
So there are obviously going to be pleasure workers working in these, gay pleasure workers working in some of these bars as well. I'll give you an example. I went to I went into the gay sex district with a friend, and we went up some stairs, and we went up on about the third or fourth floor, and every floor there were these doors. It was like a hotel, and the doors have names placarded above them, and each door is a bar.
Right.
It's not a bedroom,
yes,
but it operates like a condo. But you go in, and they're no bigger than a condo, actually. Right. And you just go in, there's a bar there, and there's a barman, and there's all the drinks and a bit of music playing, and you've got to open the door you can't see anything from outside at all.
Yes.
So that was my encounter with the gay scene, such as it is. It's a bit lower key than the straight scene in Tokyo, but it's there, and it's, you know, you can find it, and it's growing.
Yeah.
The gentleman's bars for the straight guys, some of those I went in were very, very plush, very nice. Again, they're operating in skyscrapers, where there might be offices above and below,
mm-hmm,
and then there's a floor just of these bars. You go in, you've got to know they're there. You wouldn't normally find them. The Japanese don't speak English so much.
I was going to ask about the language.
Very, very little. Yeah. Very little in English. Nothing's in English. None of the signs are in English. So you, unless you've got connections, it's not going to be easy to find your way around. But I had them. We got taken to a gentleman's bar in the district of Ginza. Now, those of you who know Tokyo will know Ginza is a very upmarket.
It's a shopping area.
Yeah, it's a lovely spot. I like Ginza particularly, and I enjoyed being around Ginza. We went there one night. We'd had dinner. We got there to one of these gentlemen's bars about 8:30. It was not too big, but there was a barman. There was a guy attendant, a male attendant. There was what we call a mama san here in Thailand. There was the female owner manager who's looking after the girls, and there are about 7 or 8 girls. Now, these girls are not sex workers; they're pleasure workers in the fullest sense. They're not there for sex. If you are able to arrange an encounter with one of these girls and take her out, that's a different arrangement. That's almost like a girlfriend boyfriend thing. These girls are not having sex on the premises. There's none of that. It's completely clean. All they're doing is talking to you.
Yes.
So you've got many of these gentlemen's bars. Some of them have just Korean girls, South Korean girls working in them. Some of them have Japanese girls working in them. The one that I went to had Japanese girls. And the Japanese girls are all educated. They've all got PhDs. Some of them are doctors. Some of them are PhD candidates. Some of them are doing MAs. Some of them are all sorts. Middle-class girls. Smart. Do converse in English. Enough, anyway. So you go along there. What are you going for? Well, this is the bizarre thing about Japan. You're just going to talk. That's all you're going to do. And the bar closes about 11:30. So by midnight, it's closed and everybody's gone home.
Sounds like a British pub.
It's very, except for the prices, which I'll come on to. So you go in and, you know, you sit down, and I was with two friends, one Chinese, one Japanese. I ordered, I think I'd already had dinner, we'd had a couple of glasses of wine, I'd already had a couple of beers. So all I had between about 8:30 and when we left at 11 o'clock were two beers, two small bottles of beer. And I was talking to these two girls mostly, again, to find out, you know, about them and what they were doing and the job. And
were they drinking?
They don't drink. They drink a little, but if they do, they'll drink very much watered down whiskey. That's what they'll drink.
And you presumably were paying for that as well.
You pay for everything. Yeah, you buy any drinks. Yeah, you pay. Yeah. Now my two friends, they had a bottle of Chivas Regal.
That sounds like the kiss of death. That frightens me.
Well, they know, you know, the whiskey out there is very popular, particularly the genuine article.
Oh, good brandy. Right. Good brandy is.
So they got this bottle of Chivas Regal, and they didn't drink all of it. They drank about half of it. The bottle's on the table, and they're coming along and topping it up. Now, the three of us were there. We had about 3 hours, I'd say, talk with these girls, buying a few drinks, no food. That came to £500. £500. Mm. Now, the friend of mine, Moto, who took me to that bar with my friend Patrick, and Moto's Japanese, his father apparently has been known to go to these places, and he spent £1,000, 2 or 3 hours, just buying drinks.
Mm.
You soon knock up that sort of money. So you're into that sort of money very quickly if you're not careful. And it was pleasant enough. But while I was in that bar, and I say there's any number, there must be hundreds, thousands of bars like it across Tokyo, there's a stream of Japanese businessmen coming in. And they're coming in, they're talking to the girls, they're staying there, they're having a drink, they're having a relaxation, they're having a laugh, and then they're going home.
Yes.
These girls are the modern day geishas.
Yes.
They're performing the same sort of ritual, yes, if you like. Wiping the brow of the stressed out male businessman.
And stroking their egos, probably.
And absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Chris, that's very important. They're making these guys feel good about themselves as men.
Yeah.
There's no sex involved. This is not a sexual encounter.
Yeah.
It's not on the table. There's no menu. Or we're going to do this, that, and the other. None of that you would get in Thailand. It's simply providing a safe environment for artificial intimacy.
Yes.
And you pay heavily for it.
Yes.
And if you can't afford to pay for it, what are you going to do? You're going to, what a lot of these young guys will do, they'll save up for maybe an encounter in a massage parlor, which won't have the same
Well, there won't be a mental element there. It's just a physical element, isn't it? It sounds like you're talking about a mental element rather than a physical one.
Yeah, there's a lot of physical goes off. And I was on one of the days I was in Tokyo. We went on the train to visit an international school, and the train journey was about 30 minutes. So we're talking the quite faster train, so you know it's quite a way out.
Yes,
but it's still in the larger conurbation of Greater Tokyo, but it's in the suburbs. I went to this international school, spent some hours there, I was doing some work, and left the international school. We went out for lunch, and the owner of the school and colleagues took us out for lunch, and we went in a car. We drove about another 10 minutes away from the school, still in this suburb. I get out of the car, And I see this building, and it looked initially, we weren't going to this building, we were looking for this, going to this particular restaurant, but I spotted this building next to the car park. It wasn't far from the train station. And I caught, something about it caught my eye, and I thought, that looks like a cinema, sort of thing you'd see in the UK, a sort of disused cinema, that sort of architecture. And I saw a sign, and the sign, I can't remember what it said exactly, but there were about five of these signs positioned on the building wall. The signs maybe about 2 foot by 3 foot in colour. And the signs all said the same thing. And they said, all happy endings start with a good beginning. Now, you know what that means. He's smiling. Chris is smiling. All happy endings start with a good beginning.
I could make a good guess.
Yeah. Well...
Wait a minute, they almost pinched that out of the Relationship Manifesto book, didn't they? And you've got a quote there about, so every person in the world started off with a...
orgasm.
Yes.
Similar, yeah. Well, the concept of the happy ending is something that's used a lot in over in Asia, particularly. I've come across it in Taiwan as well. And that's all it was. And I asked my host what this was, and it's a massage parlour.
Yes.
But it's a massage parlour that does sex.
Happy endings.
It does happy endings. And it was in a suburb.
Yes.
And it was completely legit. It wasn't hiding anything. They had some pictures. Once you look closer, you could see some pictures of the girls. And it was by a railway station. Apparently, according to my host, this is quite common in Japan. Lots of these sorts of massage parlors by the railway stations, where guys on the way somewhere will stop off, have a bit of relaxation in one of these massage parlours, get back on the train and go home.
Yeah.
The other thing that I noticed in Tokyo was the predominance now, and it's a growing market, the predominance of the male pleasure worker. You've got to ask yourself, what are the women doing who are not having sex? They're having to buy it.
Oh, sorry, you're talking about the male... pleasure worker for females, not the male pleasure worker for males.
No, the male pleasure worker for females. And I must have seen any number of these establishments with big pictures of these of young Japanese and Korean guys, and they have the number one worker is positioned at the top of this hierarchy, and they have photos down.
Yes,
right. So you may have 20 of these photos.
Bit like the headmaster at the top, followed by his deputies.
Yeah, quite. Right. But these guys, it's big business. And it's the women who are going and buying the time.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And that's a big change. So you've now got more a very open and increasingly explicit sex industry, which is creating for straight Japanese women. And they're buying time with young Japanese guys, young Korean guys. And they're going to places like Shinjuku, sex districts, to do it. And that they must be big, because I saw so many of these places. And we're not talking gay. This is outside the gay district.
Yes, yes.
It's in the straight district, and it's young guys catering for the women. So there's something happening in Japan, which is quite fascinating. And really, I was really struck by the whole paraphernalia and dynamic of gender sexual relationships. Very sexy place, amazing metropolis, wonderful city. I can't wait to go back. But really, when it comes to sex, I'm sorry, it's completely fucked up.
You know, I thought you were going to say it's just unaffordable.
It's also unaffordable, yeah. Unaffordable. You know.
I have to admit,
but for sociologists, it's a wonderful place to visit.
Yeah, I love this term, the pleasure worker, because really we've gone through nearly 40 podcasts and we talk about sex workers a lot of the time, but if I going back and reflecting on it, pleasure workers would fit in.
Pleasure worker works perfectly, and it's one of those terms I'm going to continue using it, because that's what I've been seeing, whether you're the gay, straight, whatever. The other thing I didn't see in Japan, I only saw two in all the time I was there, lady boys. You see very, very little of that, whereas in Thailand many lady boys,
yes.
Katoi,
yes.
Big thing here. You don't see it in Japan. The guys tend to dress masculine, whether they're gay, straight, or in the lady boy,
yes.
Katoi arena. But the pleasure worker, And that's what the hostesses are doing in gentlemen's bars. They're just sitting there talking and providing pleasure and stroking the male egos.
Yes. It makes much more sense. And I suppose the problem with sex workers, you assume that the sex worker is a pleasure worker with a happy ending. But not all pleasure workers give happy endings, do
not
they?
All of them do, no. And that was very apparent in from what I saw in Tokyo. Yeah. I'm not saying they won't go out with someone they meet in a gentleman's bar in a professional way, but I think that's something you'd have to arrange and you'd have to negotiate that, and it might become more of a pseudo girlfriend boyfriend situation.
Yeah, great term. I love it, actually. That it makes much more sense.
It's much less judgmental, and it's much less pejorative.
Yes,
and it also captures the what's really at the heart of this. Really, which is pleasure, whether it's physical pleasure, emotional pleasure, just feeling comfortable.
Yes,
and it's very clear. You know, the idea that this is all about men objectifying women's bodies in a very harsh way. Now, we know that's part of this world, the world that we can identify as prostitution, but we've also now got increasingly, and it's happening in the East. We've got increasing numbers of women who are looking to buy this sort of pleasure time. Whether it leads to their own happy ending or whether it leads to their own female egos being stroked or just feeling good with a guy. I know it's happening here in Thailand. Mm. I've come across people who've done research into it in Bangkok. I know it's happening in Bangkok. I very clearly can see it very explicitly happening in Tokyo.
Yes. Well, brilliant. That was good. Well, thanks for sharing that. That was good. I'm going to look forward to the Taiwanese story. Yeah. It's difficult to beat after that. That's really, really interesting. No, I'm not going to ask any questions about it because we should bring it to an end because we're on 50 minutes already. And maybe actually thinking about it, if you want to start off again next week and continue some of the stories. And
well, there are similarities between the two places. They're physically not that far apart, and culturally not that far apart. Though Taiwan's going through a particular change at the moment in terms of the sex industry, which is very significant. It's coincided with my visit.
Yeah. Okay, maybe it was because of your visit. Do you think it may have?
I know I have some influence, but not that much.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks, Stephen. And boys and girls, thanks for listening. I hope you found that interesting. As the normal reminder is, the blog is at relationshipmanifesto.postrus.com. And, of course, if you want to buy the book now, you can do that. I've not been able to say this before. You just go to Amazon and choose the Kindle store from the drop-down menu or bit that says everything and search for Relationship Manifesto, and you can download it to whatever ebook reader device you're using. We missed anything, Steve?
I think that's it. Thanks for listening.
That's very much. And Taipei, watch out. See we come next week. Thanks very much, ladies and gents. Have fun.
This recording is part of a Relationship Manifesto podcast series with Chris Smith and Stephen Whitehead.